As we have noted, Blendon's health is certainly beginning a long downwards decline starting in the mid-1950s. Les Oberg, the last of his chauffeurs, was appointed to serve him as his personal attendant. Oberg was a practical, down-to-earth man who tended to Blendon's needs and stoically put up with his quirks and demands. When the fastidious Blendon became convinced that Oberg's shaving technique left scattered whiskers behind, the attendant shaved him four times in a row each day, twice with a safety razor and twice with an electric shaver. A list of instructions for Oberg is interesting to peruse and gives us a little glimpse at these last months. A company officer wrote the document, and it starts, "In order to clarify a few responsibilities and duties of the job which you are starting, I would like to explain that this job was established by Mr. Blendon for the purpose of giving him the help he requires during the day. Therefore, your primary responsibility is that of serving Mr. Blendon as he needs you. There are no set hours of work, as I've explained to you before, but your work will start when Mr. Blendon arises in the morning and will go on intermittently throughout the day until he retires at night. Mr. Blendon asks that during those periods of time when he does not need you, that you keep him advised as to where you can be reached or what time you will return. Mr. Blendon does not require any special uniform, but he expects you to dress neat and clean at all times when serving him. Mr. Blendon's car is a 1951 Cadillac. Mr. Blendon expects it to be kept clean and in good repair at all times, making daily checks, if necessary, of such items as battery, tires, and oil. On any purchase of items for the car, such as polish and so on, you will secure an order from the purchasing department. When out for drives, 30 to 40 miles an hour is as fast as Mr. Blendon desires to go. If occasion should arise when more speed is needed, your good judgment or Mr. Blendon's direction will tell you so. Also, you will be expected to learn to operate and care for the Gulfmobile, the electric car which is used to transport Mr. Blendon through the mill. I suggest you talk to the head electricians in the mill, and they can give you detailed instruction as to its care and operation. You're expected to keep your living quarters neat and clean. You can secure linen and towels from the housekeeper as required by you. You will find that Mr. Blendon would prefer treating his help in the house not as servants, but as members of his family. He expects them to get along with each other and work together. He does not condone waste in any way. As an example, when a light is not needed, turn it off. There are many other details of this job which you will learn as you go along. Don't hesitate to ask questions when you are in doubt. I want to stress once more that your main responsibility is that of serving Mr. Blendon. If you do this to his satisfaction, I can assure you that your association with him will be enjoyable, interesting, and an education in itself." Yeah, and certainly a trying job. It would be a difficult role to fulfill. Oberg was not always inclined to submit to Blendon's penchant for argument on days that began at 6 a.m. and often lasted until 10 p.m. Sometimes the two men entered into loud and angry-sounding exchanges that caused alarm to those who overheard. But Blendon was willing to accept more from Oberg than from anyone else. Blendon always cleared the air after tense moments, asking, "You're not going to go away mad, are you?" And both would laugh. The attendant carried Blendon to his car, and the drives in the country that he'd always enjoyed were one of his last pleasures in life. In August of 1957, Blendon was driven to the annual mill picnic. A photograph taken as he sat in the car, grimly but with determination watching races, was published in the Broke Pile. Blendon's last outing a short time later was a drive to inspect the progress of landscaping at Gun Park, being developed north of town by the paper company. Parsimonious to the last and always the careful planner, Blendon, when told that his Cadillac needed new tires, knew that his own time was limited and he insisted on retreads for the expensive car. He was annoyed with the number of pills the druggist prepared for him. After all, they'd be wasted if he were gone before they were used, and he requested fewer in each batch. Blandon did not like to dine alone, and he always arranged to have someone with him. He sometimes extended invitations at the last minute, but he was always polite and gracious at the table, although some remembered in later years his necessarily bland and soft food that was not particularly satisfying. But he avoided dominating the conversation, and they were pleasant occasions. A recurrent theme in his thoughts and discussions during those last months was the wish that he had traveled more when he'd had the opportunity. Only once in the 1920s had he made a brief trip to Europe, and he had discovered the pleasures of Florida late in life. During the fall of 1957, Blandon's health took a sharp turn for the worse. Writing to a new foundation trustee, William Oppenheimer, in October stated, "Mr. Blandon has been very poorly and has had us wondering whether he would be able to recover." Blandon did rarely, but in January of 1958, after a visit to Grand Rapids, Oppenheimer wrote, "Mr. Blandon is very low, so low, in fact, that he did not recognize me, could not talk, and has lost his hearing. He's under an oxygen tent part of the time and is being kept alive by blood transfusions and intravenous feeding. He may go at any time, or as the doctor says, he may last for a number of weeks. The end, however, is inevitable." In February, Blandon's grandchildren, Bruce and Helen, were summoned to Grand Rapids. Bruce Blandon was stationed in Hawaii at the time, and he flew to St. Paul to join his sister for the drive north. Charles Blandon had always disliked hospitals, and he was at home in the villa when they arrived. He seemed dimly aware of their presence. Bruce and Helen then returned to St. Paul, only to be called back to Grand Rapids with the message that their grandfather was dying. They returned to find him in a deep coma. Bruce Blandon, without his grandfather's best wishes, but with the support of his mother and father, had firmly embraced the Roman Catholic faith. He wondered as he stood by the bedside whether his grandfather had ever even been baptized. Knowing that Blandon had never accepted any one faith, but with deep concern, Bruce located a priest and made arrangements for its grandfather to receive the last rites of the Roman Catholic Church. That would have been very annoying to Blandon if he could ever have known that that was going to happen. But at any rate, shortly after receiving those rites, and less than 2 months before his 86th birthday, on Sunday morning, February 9th, 1958, Charles Blandon died without regaining consciousness. A simple funeral service conducted by Pastor Kane, as earlier requested by Blandon, was held at the Community Presbyterian Church. Bruce Blandon, present in his Air Force uniform, shook many hands and was particularly struck by the large numbers of people who lived in the woods or spent their lifetime running a machine, so many with tears in their eyes. Officers and employees of the paper company served as pallbearers, and the trustees of the Blandon Foundation formed an honorary escort. It was Blandon's wish to be buried on a plot of land across the river from the mill near the villa. State and county requirements were fulfilled, and the land was designated a legal private cemetery. The site once had served as an Indian burial ground alongside the beautiful rushing Grand Rapids of the Mississippi River, but for many years it had overlooked the more serene waters of the Mill Dam Reservoir. There, amidst the flowers and shrubbery of the Mill Gardens, Charles Blandon was interred. Immediately following the funeral, Bruce and Helen and a few others gathered at the villa to hear for the first time the provisions in Blandon's will for family members. Not knowing what to expect, they listened as the pertinent sections were read. Bruce was to receive $5,000 plus a monthly stipend of $50. Helen was to receive a like amount and, given her five children, a monthly stipend of $100. There were similar arrangements for Blandon's sister Violet. For for Helen's children, Blendon's great-grandchildren, there would be $300 per year during grade school or high school and $400 per year during college, plus $1,000 on graduation. Only one of her children took advantage of that. Further provisions gave the trustees discretion to dispense funds for major illnesses or special circumstances, and over the years they have occasionally done so. While members of the family knew his estate would not be placed in their hands, on several public occasions Blendon had read sections of his will indicating to the community that his major goal was to ensure the survival of the paper company and to provide adequate funding for the foundation. Bruce Blendon was surprised that the will was read so soon after the funeral. When he first learned of his own bequest, his reaction was, "Well, this is hardly going to pay for my way back to Hawaii." But his acceptance of the terms was matter of fact, and with passing years, his thoughts were quite in harmony with those of his grandfather. Reflecting in 1982, he commented, "Money is not the key to happiness and mainly gives one something else to worry about." Bruce continued, "Money given too easily leads to lost incentive," and he concluded that receiving a large amount would probably have been the worst thing that could have happened to me. CK had that figured out right. Helen also reflected on the terms of the will many years after the death of her grandfather. "He was always afraid that if we had too much, we'd be spoiled, and he didn't want that. He wanted everyone to stand on their own 2 feet." She remembered her grandfather as always nice to my family and appreciated the aid provided for her children's education. The executors of the will were granted the authority to dispose of all of Blendon's personal effects. Some, especially those in a list of items Jenny had wanted her granddaughter to have, were given to Helen. Blendon's housekeeper suggested that Bruce take anything he wanted before the household goods were dispersed. Considering his trip back to Hawaii, he declined the offer. Later, he regretted that decision, as there was one memento that he really wanted. Charles Blendon often wore a diamond stick pin. It's clearly visible on his tie in the Carl Rowan oil portrait that had been commissioned by people in Grand Rapids, with more than 2,000 of them contributing towards it. The elaborate pin was a symbol of triumph over early adversity. Some years after the reading of the will, long after the household effects were scattered and gone, the stick pin was unexpectedly delivered to Bruce. He wore it once, found it too ostentatious, and had the three diamonds remounted in a ring for his wife Rosemary. She wore it always and often explained to friends the special meaning that those diamonds held. And next time, we'll look at the rest of the will and the terms that were of interest to Grand Rapids.